Professor Bernard C. Latihan was born in 1939 in Pretoria and completed his undergraduate and master's study, his MA was in Greek, at the University of Free State before studying theology at the University of Stellenbosch. He continued doctoral studies in the area of New Testament at the University of Utrecht and the Theologische Hochschule in Kampen, the Netherlands, and received his PhD in 1967, writing his dissertation entitled The Historical Jesus in the Preaching of Paul under Hermann Ritterbos. After serving as a pastor in the Congregation of George on the southern coast of South Africa, Professor Latihan was appointed Professor of New Testament at the University of Western Cape in 1969, and he moved to the University of Stellenbosch in 1977 to head the Department of Biblical Studies. In connection with his New Testament work, he established Scriptura, an international journal of Bible, theology, and religion in southern Africa. More lately, though, he has been working in areas directly related to the social and political developments in the Republic of South Africa. He initiated the Interdisciplinary Program for Values and Policy Study, served for 6 years as Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at Stellenbosch, and is at present Special Academic Advisor to the Rector for the transformation of the university's entire academic program. In fact, his current project is the contribution of theology to strengthen civil society and to promote reconciliation in southern Africa after that country's transformation to democracy, a topic which he spoke eloquently on last evening. Today, though, he returns to his first love, scriptural interpretation. He is a genuine world authority on hermeneutics in its historical, linguistic, literary, and theological dimensions. He was a natural for the first plenary speaker for this symposium, whose focus is reaching into the scriptural text. He will set the stage for all of the presentations which follow. Help me to welcome then Professor B.C. Latihan.
Thank you very much indeed for your kind introduction. I'm looking forward also a little bit with trepidation to this presentation. I think before we start, my good friend James Wiltz should be congratulated for his rhetorical ability to convince the committee to take the risk of inviting me. And I think we should commend the committee for their courage to take this risk. And now you're a captive audience, and here you have really no choice to be with me. As I understand, my task is to do three things. First of all, to provide a general introduction to the topic that we shall be examining in more detail in the next 2 days. Secondly, to review recent developments in the area of theological hermeneutics. And thirdly, to highlight issues of special homiletical significance when we move into the text. And Glenn has certainly made my task much easier to set that scene in a very special way. I shall try to do my bit by drawing and outline a map of the hermeneutical process. This will hopefully provide a framework that can serve as a point of reference when we deal with the complex phenomenon that we call a text. We shall first start with the very bare essentials of this text, and then slowly we will build that up as we go along. So, in order to achieve this goal, we shall remind ourselves first of all of the special features of the biblical text. And then we shall reveal the latest developments in the field. And finally, we will look at special aspects of the importance from a homiletical perspective. So that is what I will try to do. Say something about the nature of the biblical text. Sorry, I just have to. Secondly, to start with a basic map, then to take us very briefly through the three waves in the history of interpretation, before we expand that map again, and then to find a way into the text and look at its special features. So, first of all, the nature of the biblical text. Hermeneutics, as you all know, is supposed to be the theory of interpretation, and exegesis the practice thereof. In more general terms, hermeneutics can be described as the art of understanding, or the conditions that make understanding possible. In this presentation, the emphasis will be on hermeneutics as a way to discover the dynamic of the biblical text. I'm not going to discuss in this context the whole issue of the authority of Scripture, which is a fascinating subject on its own. But I take as my point of departure that when we attend a seminar with an homiletical intent, we are approaching the biblical text with a specific expectation. In the church, to use the formulation of Karl Barth, the reading of the Bible takes place between memory and expectation. The memory that this text has spoken to many generations of believers in the past, and the expectation that it will do so again in future. The biblical text is therefore, in the first instance, a dynamic entity. And for that very reason, it has to be approached with care. It has the appearance of a static structure, a formalized text that has been preserved unaltered through the ages and handed over unchanged by generations of believers. But this appearance, I would argue, is deceptive. The static form is, in fact, the record of a preceding event, an event of understanding, and the purpose of recording the event is to make further acts of understanding possible. Jesus said and did many things, but these have been written in order that you may believe, the last chapter of John. The text, therefore, is suspended action. It mediates between the original event of understanding and the intended event of understanding in the sermon. And in a certain sense, we could say that the task of hermeneutics is to set the temporarily frozen action in motion again, and to release the pent-up power of the text. Doing things with words, as Glenn has also said, and you immediately recognize the affinity of hermeneutics with speech act theory. But the text, secondly, besides being a dynamic, it is also dense, in the sense of being extremely concentrated. Also in this respect, the appearance is deceptive. What looks like simple stories, parables, and songs are in fact the meeting point of different worlds of understanding, of different universes. The text offers clues that lead us to different worlds, ancient and modern, worlds of authors, of their readers, of different ways to understand the world. And often these are worlds within worlds. The story worlds of parables, of biblical narratives, are embedded in the worlds of the actual persons involved in telling and hearing them. And the world of the text eventually comes in contact with our world as modern readers. The text is then the crossover point where the lines from all these wide-flung stories somehow meet. The crossover point is dense, concentrated, and requires delicate and careful handling if we are to disentangle the different strands. But this is part of the job of hermeneutics. But thirdly, the text is also dialectical in nature. As we've seen, it has the appearance of being static, but in fact, it is dynamic. As a structure, it contains both synchronic and diachronic elements. It uses both paradigmatic and syntagmatic components. Perhaps the most powerful dialectic lies in the fact that it brings God's word in human words, talking about the logos in the logoi or the logois of human language. Jean Rond puts it in this way: theology produces texts in the act of reflecting on texts. The text of the sermon is where the text of the Bible momentarily finds its outlet. What we should not miss is the fact that it is this very dialectic of the text that drives the process of communication and necessitates the ongoing process of interpretation. To find our way through the dynamic, the dense, and the dialectical nature of the text, we need a clear and trustworthy map. But this map must also make provision for all the elements involved in producing and interpreting text. We therefore also need a map that takes an holistic approach to the text. So let us begin then with the very simple communication model that no doubt you are also very familiar with. The very simple model of the sender, the message, and the receiver. These are the basic elements of the biblical text, but also of the sermon text. It may look overly simple, but I ask you to have some patience and bear with me as we build this model up through various steps by adding information and detail as we go along. Eventually, we hope to capture on the map all the elements that are involved in communication in the full sense of the word. Perhaps you've been working with a different model of communication and better suited for your needs, so please hang on to that. I'm not trying to impose anything on you. All we are trying to do is to establish a common starting point so that we know where we are and what we're talking about, where we are at a certain moment of our discussion. Now, against this background, I will move into the next section, and that is to give a very brief overview of the history of interpretation. What has happened in the area of hermeneutics recently? That is, since you left seminary. Quite a lot has happened. But in order to understand the significance of these recent developments, we need to take a little bit of a longer approach and remind ourselves of some major milestones in the history of interpretation. This history can best be summarized in distinguishing three successive waves: a historical, a structural, and an existential wave. But first of all, we have to be quite clear in our minds that hermeneutics is not a modern invention. The need to interpret is present right from the very first encounter between God and mankind. The first temptation in the Genesis story is a matter of interpretation. Satan asks Eve, "What has God told you? That you may not eat from the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden?" And then he offers an alternative interpretation. "It may be that God does not want you to know all he knows. Therefore, he forbade you to eat from the fruit." And Eve, and eventually Adam, act on this alternative interpretation. And the rest is history. Interpretation is essential to discerning the will of God. And throughout the Old and the New Testament, this is a constant theme. Individuals like Moses and the prophets, and even a whole class of people like the scribes in the post-exilic period, act as interpreters of God's will. It is a style that characterizes the the ministry of Jesus itself. His public appearance, as you well know, begins. His first public appearance with the interpretation of Isaiah 61. And that sets the stone of his ministry as a whole, the antitheses in the Sermon on the Mount, the parables, the discourses. The temptation story is a classic example of an hermeneutical debate. What is God's will in this moment? Paul's mission to the Gentiles is in essence a reinterpretation of the gospel in a Hellenistic context. Apocalyptic literature reveals the same hermeneutical tendencies. And in a broader sense, the New Testament can be understood as an interpretation of the old. So the need for interpretation is inherent in the nature of the biblical text itself. After the formation of the canon, the need for interpretation continued through the period of the apostolic fathers to the Middle Ages. And this time, exegesis became more and more subjected to dogma. The Reformation brought a fundamental change in the hermeneutical thinking. And Luther's insistence that the Bible should be understood first and foremost as the living word, the viva vox of God, presented a major breakthrough. The Bible is not an historical document in the first place, but a text for preaching. But this is also the only source of revelation and of the message of salvation, sola scriptura, and not tradition nor the subsequent formulated dogma. If tradition and ecclesiastical authority no longer serve as the controlling forces in the process of interpretation, a heavy responsibility is placed on the exegesis itself. And the Reformation, therefore, also marks the beginning of intense hermeneutical and exegetical activity that has strongly influenced subsequent developments. For the purposes of this brief overview, we can distinguish then between these three waves that I've already mentioned: an historical, a structural, and an existential or receptional phase. And as we shall see, each of these phases correlates with a specific relationship to our basic model of communication. The discovery of the Bible as the central document of the church during the Reformation, over and against tradition and dogma in the Roman Catholic Church, also meant the rediscovery of the historicity of the Bible. A renewed appreciation developed of the Bible as an historical document which in itself represents a long history. This historical interest received a powerful boost during the post-Reformation era by the emergence of rationalism and the critical attitude towards forms of authority. The implication was that the Bible had to be read primarily, and in some quarters only, as an historical document. And thus became the long tradition of historical criticism, which took many forms: textual criticism, form criticism, historical background studies, redaction criticism. This whole family of methods is based on the genetic principle. That is, the idea that insight into the origin and the development of a phenomenon contains the key to its understanding. This wave was followed by a second, the structural wave, which developed much later in time. But the structural wave took its point of departure, as the name says, in the structure of the message as such. Historically, its origins can be traced back to the work of the Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure at the beginning of the century, who is now being considered as the father of modern linguistics, with additional influences coming from as far afield as the Russian formalism, the Prague school, French structuralism, semiotics, theory of signs, etc. In these circles, the text is viewed, as you know, as a self-contained entity, a network of relationships that forms a world on its own. Not its history, but the nature of these internal relationships holds the key to the understanding of the text. And what's therefore needed is text-immanent exegesis, an approach that takes the network of textual relationships as its point of departure. Important for our purpose is to realize that the text contains many different types of structures: linguistic, literary, poetic, narrative, discursive, argumentative, rhetorical, or thematic structures, all calling for their own form of analysis. Thirdly, we have the existentialist or reception-oriented wave. That is the most recent, although it has its first beginnings already in the beginning of the century with the work of the existentialist philosophers and exegetes. Bultmann's program of Entmythologisierung was in essence an attempt to make the first century text of the New Testament accessible to the reader of the 20th century. Whether he succeeded in that program is another question, but that was his intention. Existential referred to the existence of the modern reader. And the common feature of all reception theory approaches is that they recognize the active contribution this recipient reader makes to the process of understanding. Wolfgang Iser, an important exponent of this approach, even claims that the text does not have an existence on its own, but is only produced by the interaction between reader and the text. In the development of the so-called contextual hermeneutics, as we will see a little bit later, reception theory was one of the major influences. The questions which gave rise to each of these three waves did not go away once the next wave made itself felt in biblical interpretation. They were valid questions in their own right and need to be accounted for. And for this purpose, we shall now return to our basic map. It is now clear that each of the waves we have reviewed very briefly in the previous section focuses on a specific aspect of our communication model. The historical wave is interested in questions of text production and therefore deals with the relationship text-sender. That first relationship. The questions are, who wrote the text? How was it composed? What were the historical circumstances at the time? How was the message handed down, what Glenn mentioned as reading behind the text? The structural wave is interested in questions of text mediation. And deals with questions like, what genre is this? What is the relationship between the internal elements of the text? What is its rhetorical intent? And obviously, the receptionist wave is interested in questions of text reception. And that is in the relationship between the text and the receiver. And the questions that is pertinent here is, who are the intended readers? What instructions are given to the reader in the text? And how did actual readers in the course of the time read the text? We can now flesh out the basic model to make provision for these new insights. In fact, the mapping of the dialectical switch in each case from the static to the dynamic element, when we follow this switch, we can begin to understand how the process of understanding is set in motion. Let me return again to the other one. Now let's come back to our basic map again. The sending of any message is dependent on a prior event of understanding. God speaking to Moses, Jesus telling a parable. This event, which in itself is a dynamic element, is formulated by the sender in the form of a text, which is a static element. And the message therefore appears to the present reader in a static form, but nonetheless conceals, as I've tried to point out, a dynamic potential in itself. As sense, the sign is static, but as reference, it refers beyond itself and presents its dynamic side. The receiver, in his or her turn, starts with the static structure of the text in the hope that this will lead to a new event of understanding as its dynamic counterpart. So this dialectic between static and dynamic in all three of the sectors of the textual process is the motor behind the textual communication process as such. Now, how do we find a way into the text, as our theme and topic for these 2 days is suggesting? The text is, as we've seen, a concentrated bundle of energy, ready to release this energy with constructive effect when handled with respect and care, but also potentially with damaging results if approached in the wrong way. At the same time, it is a remarkable complex phenomenon, a meeting place of so many diverse strands that it easily can become a maze in which the interpreter loses his or her way. Now, how do we find a way into and through the text? How do we enter this maze in such a way that we do not get lost, but also we discover the riches that it has to offer and the power of its message? Ernst Fuchs, a remarkable New Testament scholar and a pioneer of hermeneutics in the middle of the century, uses a striking metaphor. If you want to know what a cat is, you must put the right object in front of that cat. If you put a cup of tea in front of the cat, you are almost sure to get no reaction. But if you put a mouse in front of that cat, the reaction is totally different. The cattiness of the cat immediately comes to the fore. The true nature of the cat becomes clear in the way that it reacts to the mouse. So the secret of interpretation, Fuchs said, is to finding the appropriate mouse for the cat, or the appropriate question that you put to the text. That is his way of saying, this is the key, the question that we put to the text. And Glenn has already suggested one of the questions that we can put to this text. But to be absolutely clear, what it is that we ask from the text is one of the best ways that for us to reach within into the text with confidence. Now let us review some of these questions. First of all, we could ask, what are you asking? What exactly are you looking for? Are you looking for archaeological evidence regarding the construction methods in the early Bronze Age? Are you looking for the flora and fauna in biblical times? Are you asking a question about the aorist in Koine Greek, the narrative structure of Jesus' parables, rhyming patterns in Hebrew poetry, the sociological function of this extended family in pre-exilic Israel, the Roman system of provincial administration in the first century, the middle verse of the St. James Version? In this respect, the text of the Bible can be very patient because it fields all these questions, and it will answer almost all these questions. What you ask is what you get. Ask a frivolous question, and you're likely to get a nonsensical answer. If we are reaching into the text in order to prepare for the sermon, the substance of the questions we put to the text will determine the substance of the answers. The second set of questions, who is asking the questions? Not only the question itself, but the subject is of critical importance. We are seldom aware that what the difference this can make to the answer that we get. Is it an academic asking this for academic reasons? Is it a preacher desperately looking for a text for Sunday sermon? Is the member of congregation in a deep personal crisis? Is it the so-called ordinary reader, someone from a marginalized group, a woman reading in a male-dominated environment, the powerful in society, the powerless, an outsider? Now, have you ever experienced that as a stranger in a different country, as an outsider in a specific community, that you read the Psalms quite differently? That you suddenly understand more clearly when David talks about being a stranger himself. Readings are not anonymous, but they involve real people of flesh and blood and are related to real life issues. But the third set of questions. With what purpose do we read? Normally the questions are asked from a mono perspective, and therefore we get, if all works well, valid but often one-dimensional answers. Answers about building methods in ancient times, grammatical constructions, literary forms, statistical data. But when we are reaching into the text in order to make a sermon, we have a more complex aim in mind. What does this mean for the understanding of the message, for ministering to people, for proclaiming the gospel? This is a second-order question. Sermon making requires more than a mono or first-order set of questions. But then that is very, very important to grasp. We do not get to second-order answers without asking and answering first-order questions first. To put it differently, we get answers to second-order questions only through an indirect route via first-order questions. That is one reason, maybe you have discovered now for the first time, why you have to read Greek. What else Dr. Wiltse has tried to convince you with. Greek is a first-order question in order, for first-order knowledge in order to get to that substantial second-order question. And that is also clear why a mono approach can lead to distortions. However valid the answer can be to a mono question, it is never the full answer to the meaning of the text. We have to enter somewhere, and we have to enter the point at some text, at some point, and we shall always read it from a specific perspective. But if we read only from this perspective, and if we believe that one hermeneutical approach or one exegetical method can supply the full answer, we shall inevitably end with a one-sided and impoverished picture. Sometimes when we are questioning the text in terms of our own needs and our own agenda, the roles are suddenly reversed. We are the ones that are being questioned by the text. And that, I think, is what I anticipate from Dr. Wiltse's paper when he names that the text strikes back. We are therefore to return to our basic model and look more carefully at the relationships that are activated as soon as we start reading the text with the sermon as ultimate aim in mind. And so let's return then to explore the text from these perspectives. We're now in a position to return to our basic model and start adding further refinements. We have already seen that the focus on the left-hand side of the model is on text production, the focus on the center on text mediation, and the focus on the right on text reception. The text, in fact, is a meeting point of two axes. And here I'm going to use the model of Hernardi that might be also familiar to you. What we have talked about so far is the horizontal axis moving from left to right in this picture, representing the diachronic or the movement through time from the sender via the text to the receiver. This is also called the syntagmatic axis and coincides with the way that a sentence is strung together by placing one word next to the other to form a meaning-producing string. This also represents the dynamic movement in the communication process, which flows from the sender to the receiver. This horizontal axis is then crossed by a vertical axis. And in due course, we'll explore this a little bit fuller. This vertical axis moves from bottom to top. This represents the way that the text constructs a world of its own. Drawing from the enormous reservoir of signs each language has, and which has no meaning as separate elements, the text represents a selection of these signs, organized in such a way that it makes sense, creating a semantic universe or a world of its own. In linguistic terms, from all the paradigmatic variations available, the text selects one possibility, producing a unique utterance. Through selection, the random signs become a structure that has meaning and that represents a world of its own. This is the synchronic dimension of the text, the frozen moment in time, and does not reflect any changes of the text over time. Because this vertical text axis leads from random verbal signs to the world of the text, we shall call it, with Hernari, the mimetic axis of representation. We can now move along these two axes and to explore the logic and that of the communication process a little bit further. Communication between sender and receiver can only succeed if there is a common code. That is, if there is overlap between the code of the sender and the receiver. If there is no minimum of overlap, no understanding is possible. The code in linguistic jargon consists of a dictionary. This is the reservoir of signs, and rules of selection. That is how we combine these signs in order to make sense. Whether the language is made up of words or of other signs, for instance, body language or Morse code, the principle remains the same. If sender and receiver do not share the same code, no communication is possible. If there is some overlap, some communication would be possible. If sufficient overlap, sufficient communication can be expected. And if almost complete overlap, excellent communication should be possible. This is the challenge every translator of the Bible has to face. There is a constant striving to merge the codes of the source and the target language, to mediate between them by someone who is an expert in both codes. But this is also the challenge for you as preacher. You may know the code of your text better than anyone, but do you know the code of those to whom you are about to preach as well? Do you know the code of the young generation, of the marginalized, and of the non-believer? So let us focus now on the issues pertaining the first relationship, the left-hand relationship between the sender and the text. We can now be more specific about the issues that we have referred to as the historical dimension of the text, and to develop this a little bit more in detail. These issues deal in the first place with questions of authorship, of the date of composition, of place of origin, of Sitz im Leben, and all the rest. These are important questions that should be pursued with all the vigor and that a good historical researcher has. The more we know about the author and the authors and their world, the better we can understand the text. New archaeological and other evidence regarding ancient civilizations and the world of the Bible are constantly coming to the fore, throwing new light on the context in which these texts originated. Furthermore, Biblical texts attest to events that took place in history and in the historical issues, therefore, cannot be avoided. Taking the historical nature of the biblical text seriously has resulted in this whole family of methods that we have already referred to. Form criticism, which assumes an oral tradition between the written text and is interested in its transition from the pre-literary to its literary form. Source criticism, which studies the relationship between the individual texts and the wider literary context and the dependence on sources. Redaction criticism starts from the assumption that the individual authors of the biblical books has a strong influence on their eventual form. An analysis of the composition of the text from the perspective of the final redactor is its real focus. Textual criticism is the specialized technical discipline aimed at restoring and the presumed original form of the text as accurately as possible. The most consistent and incisive application of the historical approach is certainly that of the historical critical method, which has become the basis of much, if not the majority, of exegetical work done in scholarly circles today. And this is not the place to discuss the pros and cons of this approach, but it is important to note that there is increasing dissatisfaction with the results achieved by this method. The limitations of the historical method becomes visible in the inability to agree on the valid reconstruction of the text and the historical events lying behind the text. And you might have noticed in the literature that there is a growing protest, a dissatisfaction, disenchantment with the results of the historical critical process. Recently, interest in the situation of origin has returned in the form of what is called sociological exegesis. Interestingly enough, linguistics played an important part in pioneering this approach. The problems of Bible translation in transcultural settings underline the need to understand speech communities, speech events, and the sociological variables of these communities. Initially, the focus was, of course, on the target language and the receptive community, but the sociological interest soon turned also to the community of origin in an attempt to understand the world of the author better. Gad Tyson has been one of the first exponents of this approach. He is at pains to explain that his goal is not a history of events, but a history of structures. Trying to reconstruct the sociological relationship in the community of origin has a better chance of succeeding than reconstructing individual histories. But also from a hermeneutical perspective, sociological analysis can be more valuable when translating the text for a contemporary society. It is not surprising that quite a number of attempts at sociological exegesis have since been made. Another issue of historical importance is the fact that we are not the first readers of the biblical text. We are, to use Lars Hartmann's words, reading other people's letters. The gospel certainly has a universal and timeless appeal to be proclaimed to all people, but it is also clear that we are not the original intended readers, and that the original writers and the first readers are no longer available to help us understand these writings. What we do have is a record of the readings of the text through the ages. Commentaries, sermons, expositions, and the like make up what is called the Wirkungsgeschichte, or the effective history of the text, reflecting the personal situation of the readers and their social condition. These readings make a fascinating story of the influence and the effect of certain passages of Scripture through the ages. The history of dogma is a specialized form of that. So what we find is that the actual interaction is between the world of the text and the actual reader today. But we can plot that also by expanding that and maybe become aware of the whole series of readers in different times that have studied that text that he stands in a certain relationship in a historical context. So this is also where we come to the question that Glenn has referred to as the original author, or the intention of the original author. Some literary theorists hold that we can only speak about the intention of the author as it is expressed in the text. It does not constitute an independent authority that can overrule the text. In other words, the intention of the text is in fact the intention of the author. But in doing so, we have already moved into the issues pertaining the relationship of the text as structure. So if we superimpose those two axes, we have the full picture of the communication interaction and all the different aspects that we can map. For many exegetes, concentrating on the middle section of our diagram, on the text itself, is the natural starting point for all forms of exegesis. And it's not surprising that there has been strong attempts to proclaim the independence of the text as a self-contained unit. There are many strong arguments speaking for such an approach. The text does indeed form a world of its own. It is directly accessible, and it has amazing durability. Paul Ricoeur reminds us of two remarkable qualities of a written text. It has the ability to preserve relationships, and that perhaps is often not appreciated. What is written as the subject of a sentence remains the subject. It does not vary with time. Of course, an active sentence can always be translated into a passive construction, but then it becomes a different utterance. So the fixation of relationships in the text is a very important basis for not only analyzing but understanding the text. The original sentence, as I've said, does not transform itself by its own accord. Secondly, and that is also important, texts travel well. They outlive their authors, and they are not bound to the place of their origin. Despite the fragile nature of ancient written materials, the documents we deal with have been preserved remarkably well, as we all know. And the preservation of the text is perhaps one of the least of our problems. But the most significant developments in hermeneutics has been in this area. And we owe a lot to linguistics and literary theory for opening up this world of the text. I just want to illustrate two important approaches. That is the one of narrative theory and of rhetorical analysis. And Glenn, again, has touched already on both of these. If we move along the historical axis of our model, that is, across that axis, the rhetorical axis of communication, the communication of the original author that the original author has in mind is embedded in the text. We are no longer dealing with the actual author of Mark, but we hear his voice in the text. And that is what is called in narrative theory the so-called implied author. The implied author writes from a certain point of view, makes his presence felt in many ways, in the way he selects his material, and the way he structures his story, and the way that he shares information with his readers, and the way that he develops a plot in that story. If we analyze the Gospel of Mark, it is very clear that he has a certain audience, a specific reader in mind. Throughout his Gospel, he gives hints and instructions to this reader. Information needed to understand a certain point, what to expect next, how to evaluate a reaction, what is going on in the mind of Jesus. From this information, we can form a certain profile of both the author and the reader. And because these profiles are totally text-based, we talk of the implied author and the implied reader. The implied reader of Luke clearly has a special interest in the position of woman. He also implies a reader who knows Greek and he is not so familiar with Jewish customs. The implied reader is also called the addressee in many of these theories. So what we have to be aware is that quite apart from the historical author, the form that the way that the text is structured retains indications of the voice of the author in the form of the implied author. And that implied author connects in the first instance with the ideal reader or the implied reader, where the author presupposes certain knowledge, certain familiarity with codes in the implied reader. The reader instructions the implied author gives to the implied reader in the course of his story are often the most valuable clues for the preacher when examining the text with a view on preparing the sermon. Analyzing the narrative structure is often the most rewarding way for the preacher to deal with the text. The text does not only present a storyline in the historical axis of communication. The text also forms a world of its own. The world of Matthew is the world where the radical truths of the gospel unmask the pious but devious constructions of Pharisees, where the kingdom of God is offered to the poor and the powerless. The world of Galatians is a world where ancestry, privileged position, or the fulfilling of the formal requirements of the law does not guarantee salvation, but only unqualified trust in God. This applies equally to Jew or Greek, slave and free, man and woman. As Ricoeur shows, the text offers an alternative world, or rather, an alternative way at looking at the world. It challenges us to embrace this alternative and to act in terms of this new understanding of reality. When we explore the narrative structure of text, we shall deal with this in more detail. But let me touch then secondly on another important aspect of this analysis, namely of the rhetorical intention of the texts. The Bible contains almost every kind of literature, prose, poetry, history, prophecy, wisdom literature, gospels, letters, and many more. These texts can inform, entertain, instruct, encourage, and guide us. But the overall intention is to convince people, to persuade them, to make them change their ways, and to win their hearts and minds. The biblical text is a rhetorical text par excellence. The movement from the left-hand side of our model along the historical axis is a movement from the world as source of motivation to the world as field of action. The text as utterance carries with it an appeal on the receiver. The interest in the rhetorical analysis of the text is therefore motivated by the desire to do justice to the persuasive power of the text. Unfortunately, because of the abuse of rhetorical strategies in the past, these techniques have acquired a negative connotation. Now, rhetorical skills can be used to defend, as we all know, unworthy causes or to secure doubtful decisions, as we see in the courtroom and the politics of the day. Rhetoric can mean empty words, insincerity, and sleight of hand, but in its best sense, it can mean freeing the way to convince people of sin and salvation. And the Bible, as we all know, contains some of the most powerful argumentative texts with dramatic narratives where the art of persuasion is practiced at its best. For the preacher, it is not only important to recognize the rhetorical strategies that the author and the biblical text employs. For the construction of the text of his own sermon, an understanding of these strategies can be greatly beneficial. Despite the emphasis on the autonomy of the text and the center of our diagram, on the text as a self-contained unit, the text points itself points beyond itself. It points back to its origins, and it points forward towards the completion of the process of understanding. And that brings us to the final sector of our model, the relationship between the text and the receiver. By far the most neglected area in traditional theological hermeneutics is the role of the receiver. Here, the development of reception theory and reader response criticism has brought major changes to our understanding of the communication process. The first term is usually associated with a coherent literary theory and is associated by the school of Constance, the names of Isa being very prominent. The second, reader response criticism, with a wide variety of theoretical and empirical studies, the majority of North American origin. The focus of all these studies is the role of the reader, or more precisely, the creative input of the reader in the process of communication. The discussion in this area moves between various extremes. From Isa on the one hand, who denies that the text has an independent existence and holds that the text is actually produced by the interaction between the written instructions and the reader, to Stanley Fish on the other hand, who sees the interpretive community as the final arbiter of the meaning of the text. But we need not go into the subtleties of this debate at the moment. What is of more importance is that due recognition is given in these theories of the role of the reader. And we have to distinguish also here carefully between the implied reader and the real reader. The first, as we've seen in the previous section, is really the set of instructions given in the text to the reader. Whether the real reader, in actual fact, follow these instructions is another matter. Isa says that the text makes a certain Leseangebot to the reader, a certain offering of reader, of reading, a certain possibility of understanding reality that is realized in the reading process. But the text often contains gaps that the reader, him or herself, must fill, and therefore requires the active input from the reader. But how actual readers can read can only be established by empirical reader research. And unfortunately, too few of these studies are done. In most cases, one is surprised that what people really make of the text. And maybe you've done that your own experiments, and to find that people read the Bible very differently from the way that they are supposed to read it. Reader response criticism has spawned a whole series of readers, the ideal reader, the informed reader, the super reader, and many more. These are all terms to indicate that reading presupposes a minimum of shared ground between the reader and the writer. And it also led to the discussion regarding the qualities of the ideal reader that the ideal reader must have to realize the full potential of the text and to do justice to every nuance of the author's instructions. I think the sensitivity for the role of the reader has also increased our sensitivity of the reasons why the communication process in our own sermons often are not successful. The real significance of reader studies is that it yields very important information about the audience of the biblical message, the first audience, but also the contemporary audience that you have in front of you every Sunday. The text of your sermon will ring different bells, will evoke different reactions, depending on how the members of your audience is programmed. Not all the signs are picked up. Some are completely missed, and others, as you know, are wrongly interpreted. Reader response alerts us to the diversity of our own audiences, but it also explains why we have a variety of readings of the same biblical text. Women read the Bible differently than men. They pick up different nuances, In fact, they notice aspects that have escaped the attention in the standardized reading of the text. Young people read differently. The ordinary reader reads differently compared to the informed or the scholarly reader, as the studies of Gerald West have so clearly shown us. The same holds true for the different cultural groups, and especially for the minorities or marginalized groups. Minorities had to learn to read against the grain, against the dominant reading of the time. And often these alternative readings were ignored for a long time because it is difficult to make yourself heard against the dominant reading of the time. The reading of Luther was certainly one of these alternative kinds, going directly against the official interpretations of the church of his time. Understanding the role of the reader is the key to understand contextual theologies, liberation theology, black theology, feminist theology, womanist theology. All these started out as counter readings. And whether you agree with these readings or not, if you don't understand the dynamics behind the formulation or the formation of these different readings, you will not be able to communicate also in a proper way to these alternatives. Often they brought to the surface an important but neglected or forgotten dimension of the text. If this correction is accepted, the dominant reading is enriched. If it is ignored, it often led to radicalism and schism. So let me conclude. Author, text, or reader? Where should our emphasis lie in preparing for the sermon? We can enter the text from any of these perspectives. Wherever we start, the important thing is to do justice to all three dimensions. And the danger is always to absolutize one of these that leads to one-sidedness and radicalism. Hermeneutics, therefore, also have an ethical dimension, what has become known as the ethics of reading. Responsible reading and responsible hermeneutics are accountable to all dimensions of the author, the text, and its readers. This is what is meant by a holistic approach to reading, and this is the challenge that faces all of us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Bernard. The time is moving on. I think we have time for just a few questions, maybe about 4 or 5 minutes worth, if there are any. We have microphones up in front here. Please come forward and identify yourself.
Matt Sander from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. I come from Brazil, where I did some studying in theology of liberation. According to the rules of the liberation theologians, there is no basic, firm, lasting meaning to any text, but that the reader is the one that gives it his or her own meaning. Do you agree with this type of interpretation, or in your opinion, is there such a thing as a absolute, solid, unchanging meaning to each text?
Well, I think that is one way that is formulated in a one-sided way. Of course, as I've argued, that every reader in every situation will add a certain dimension to that text. But the very communication between reader and text is possible through sharing a common code. And if there is no connection possible between the original reader and the present reader, then communication falls away. So although that is a very important insight to understand the contribution of the reader, to make that the only test or the only criterion denies the fullness of the communication process. So the unchanging, the eternal meaning of that text is honored in the community of believers, because that is why every new reader is obliged to communicate not only with the text, but with former readers of the text. And it's through the community of believers that fullness of the understanding of its meaning is really understood. So my answer is, if we formulate it in that way, then we relativize the text in a way that makes it powerless and breaks the communication and the continuity between the original author and the present reader. And once that connection is broken, then there is, in fact, no possibility of receiving and storing the original attention of the text. So I would be very careful to radicalize that, and that is a very good example where the reader becomes the sole focus and the authority, and not honoring all three elements in a holistic way. I hope that answers your question in some way. Are there any other questions?
Since Robbie isn't up here. In fact, it follows on Pastor Sanders' question in terms of the role of the reader as a dynamic and not a static, an active participant in the communication process. Maybe this is more of an observation than a question, but would that apply as we move not only from a text that a preacher may use, but the sermon itself as a text?
Yes.
And I'd just sort of welcome your comments on the role of the listener. Mm-hmm. We all know that what you say in a sermon may be completely different from what people hear in a sermon.
Yes.
And I'm curious as to the role of the hearer even in that active communication process, where we don't have a written static text, we don't text, we don't have the historical problems to deal with. It's a contemporary, active, alive, real-time communication. And still this breaks down. Yeah. Could one argue that one must almost instruct the hearers? Or are we assuming an awful lot of the rules of interpretation that the implied hearer actually knows and follows the rules? Are we suggesting that it might be helpful to instruct our people in how to hear a sermon correctly?
Well, I think you're completely right. Exactly the same dynamic applies to the oral presentation of a sermon. And I think the clearer our listener instructions are in the text, the better we can expect that communication to work. But we don't do that because we assume that will happen automatically, or we don't understand how that process works. Therefore, I think it is very important to add onto our own structuring for an implied audience also the reaction of the real audience. And I would challenge you to follow that with empirical studies with your own sermons to determine exactly what people hear when you preach. And that feedback of empirical hearers could be a very important correction or input that will enrich your own understanding. And where sermon making is really holistic, it involves not only the pastor, but an active process with the listener. So I would really encourage everybody to not only understand more about that process, but really do some empirical work on how it is received.
I suspect we assume a lot, and maybe that's part of the process of even growing in the community, understanding our doctrinal positions. But there's a difference then between preaching to the choir, so to speak, in that we have to analyze the audience. And I liked your point of even if you're not preaching to the choir, and we ain't preaching to the choir anymore. If we're not preaching to the choir, how much the sermon can actually help the reader understand that we have to take some of those rules of the implied readership and pack it into the text more clearly. That's what I hear you saying.
No, that's absolutely, and I think that's what we can learn from how the instructions in the biblical text has been formulated
as a model,
as a very, very effective way of communication, often very subtle. And if we analyze some of the texts in the coming sessions, we will discover how well that's done. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, we should apply to our technique of the sermon, whether we cannot enrich and improve our own communication exactly along those lines. Yeah. I think we are totally
very
lacking in that dimension.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Bernard, you talked about the three waves of interpretation. Is there a fourth wave in your view? What's coming on? Are we returning to the first wave? What do you think is happening now?
What I see happening is that once the full process of communication has been understood and recognition given in our theories also to the reception side, that every other aspect preceding that, as I've indicated very briefly in sociological exegesis, brings a new understanding of the historical dimension of reading behind the text. It brings new insights in analyzing the text itself, and it brings new insights in communicating with the reader or the hearer. So what I see is a move towards what I would like to call a holistic approach to hermeneutics. And that might be just the way that we should also aim in our own research in order to ensure that we not only balance, but we really discover the full depth and richness of the text.
Chris Brown, a seminary student. I'm still struggling to understand how looking at the receiver informs our exegesis. May I put out what I think it is and then have you correct
yes,
it?
Yes, please, please.
On one hand, we need to be conscious of who we are as exegetes as we approach a text
yeah.
to understand how that's coloring and filtering what's coming through.
Yeah.
At the same time, be cognizant of what our hearers, how they hear a text, particularly in our liturgical setting where the text is read first and then the sermon proceeds, and there may be some great dissonance going on between what the preacher is bringing out of the text and what the hearer of the preaching has already brought out of the text from their hearing of the text. And then we have to negotiate what the difference is between those two.
No, certainly. I mean, another form is the text here, the selection of the text. That is already structuring it in a certain way. So I think we should be conscious of that. One of the dangers of being conscious is that you then lose the nerve, your nerve to preach, because often it's such a humbling experience and it becomes so complicated that you lose your nerve to go through with it, because there are so many variables, and there are so many ways that it can go wrong. But that is why we have to return to look at the simplicity and the effectiveness of the communication of these texts in the Bible. The parables, in that way, is so remarkable, but because it's so simple, it is, seems so direct, and still it conveys a whole world and a turning around of value systems that is so effective in its communication. So I think, although we become aware of these complexities, I hope that it will not lead us into desperation, but look for the reasons why communication is not only possible, but also effective. I think the sensitivity of the preacher, the ways that he or she is in actual fact communicating, can lead to a fuller understanding of the process that will hopefully also inform your preaching. So yes, be aware of that, but don't be, and that's the way, constricted and tied up in this whole process, but look at the examples of effective communication. Ask yourself, why is this working? Why is this not working? And in the end, people understand more intuitively than we often think we should do intellectually. So that is another dimension that we haven't even explored this morning.